From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
The domestic response that we have now witnessed to the war against Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda has little to do with a struggle to combat terrorism or protect the American people than a pretext, a justification for the construction of what I believe to be a national security state.
Manning Marable on globalization, race, and war. We'll look at the Bush administration and corporate America pushing for billions in tax rebates in the name of fighting terrorism, and talk to a garment worker and former mayoral candidate in Miami, fired from his job for making anti-war statements. He was making American flags. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. bombing raids in the eastern Tora Bora mountain range are continuing despite an Al-Qaeda offer to surrender, according to Western news sources. The fighters had agreed to surrender by early today, the deadline passed. But the Afghan Islamic Press and a spokesman for a U.S.-backed Afghan commander both say the fighters are asking to be handed over to the United Nations in the presence of diplomats from their respective countries. The spokesman said if the fighters didn't surrender within a couple hours, they would be killed. NBC News is reporting that hundreds of Taliban and Al-Qaeda troops, including many of their remaining leaders, have escaped from Afghanistan into neighboring Iran and Pakistan. U.S. officials believe that almost all the remaining top 22 Taliban leaders have escaped into Pakistan, mostly on foot or horseback over remote mountain trails. Meanwhile, as many as 500 Taliban and Al-Qaeda troops captured in the northern cities of Mazar-e-Sharif and Kunduz have bought safe passage into Iran. Soldiers from the U.S. 10th Mountain Division are patrolling the areas along the Pakistani border, while Pakistan said it sent 4,000 troops to the area. A federal grand jury in Virginia handed up the first criminal charges in the September 11th attacks yesterday. The charges allege a French citizen in U.S. custody was trained and funded by Osama bin Laden's network and was part of the conspiracy to crash jetliners into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Following a contentious debate among senior government officials, the White House on Monday decided to try Zacharias Moussaoui in civilian court rather than a secret military tribunal. Senior Pentagon officials and other administration officials had lobbied vigorously last month to make Moussaoui to be tried by an overseas tribunal. But after heated criticism over the use of tribunals, the Bush administration reached a compromise that would permit the trial to be held in an open criminal court, but in a jurisdiction with a strong record of imposing the death penalty. President Bush will soon tell Russia that the U.S. will withdraw from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. The Russians had hoped to preserve the treaty, which they see as a foundation of strategic stability and cornerstone of arms control agreements hammered out over the past 30 years. U.S. withdrawal, many defense experts have warned, could risk soured relations with Russia, strained ties with NATO allies, an arms buildup by China, and an unraveling of other international accords. In a speech at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina yesterday, President Bush used the September 11th attacks to justify breaking the treaty. He said, quote, suppose the Taliban and the terrorists had been able to strike America or important allies with a ballistic missile. Our coalition would have become fragile. We must protect America and her friends against all forms of terror, including the terror that could arrive on a missile. Driving Bush to act on the treaty now, officials say, is the fact that an expanded Pentagon plan of missile defense testing and development already has begun straining the accord. Israeli helicopter gunships attacked the Palestinian Authority's National Security Building in Gaza last night, killing four Palestinian civilians, injuring some 20 others. The building's located in a residential part of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Witnesses said the gunships also hit an adjacent refugee camp and said there were a large number of victims because the attack coincided with the end of evening prayers. House and Senate negotiators yesterday agreed on a far-reaching education plan that would dramatically expand student testing and hold schools responsible for closing the achievement gap separating many poor and minority students and their middle-class and white peers. Approval of the plan, which had been stalled in congressional negotiations since summer, clears the way for final action on the measure within a week. And on the home front, Pacifica National Programming Director Utrice Lead has resigned. Lead is the X-Talk show host from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. She was installed as interim general manager close to a year ago in what has been dubbed the Christmas coup at WBAI, with late-night lock changes and the termination of longtime staffers Bernard White, Sharon Harper, and Valerie Van Isler. What ensued was mass bannings and firings, along with the installation of a high-tech security surveillance system and a precipitous drop in listenership and donors. Democracy Now! Staff was forced out under Lead in August, out of WBAI. She was then promoted to the network's second highest management position, National Programming Director. Again, according to a memo from the executive director of Pacifica, Utrice Lead has resigned. We see it, you take it. Oh, make me wanna holler the way they do my life. Make me wanna holler the way they do my life. This ain't living, this ain't living. No, no, baby, this ain't living. No, 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 no. Inflation, no change. Inner City Blues, Marvin Gaye here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is what some of the biggest corporations in the U.S. would have received in tax rebates under the so-called economic stimulus plan that for the last month has been pushed by the Bush administration in the name of fighting terrorism. IBM, $1.4 billion. Ford, $1 billion. General Motors, $833 million. GE, $660 million. Enron, $250 million. In the wake of the September 11th attacks, the Bush administration and major corporations have launched an aggressive effort to push through a host of business-friendly measures wrapped in the guise of fighting terrorism. If we're to believe the pitch, drilling in the Arctic, fast-track treaty authority, massive tax cuts are now vital measures to preserve our national security. The Republican version of so-called economic stimulus, a $100 billion package of tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy that one public interest group dubbed the Campaign Contributors War Profiteering Act of 2001, includes a repeal of the alternative minimum tax, which was passed in the 1980s after major corporations exploited massive loopholes to avoid paying taxes. The Democratic version of the bill would be tilted towards spending to help the poor and those unemployed since September 11th. Congress is set to decide on a compromise version of the bill this week, setting up a stark choice between the needs of major corporations and those rendered most vulnerable since the September 11th attacks. We're joined on the telephone from Washington by Robert McIntyre, who's the director of Citizens for Tax Justice. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you with us. So, can you just explain in simple terms what the alternative minimum tax is?
Well, simply put, if a company has so many loopholes that despite making lots of money, it doesn't owe hardly anything in income taxes, then there's an alternative tax that says you still have to pay some reasonable amount if you're making a lot of money. And that's pretty much how it works.
And that was passed during the Reagan-Bush years?
It was adopted in 1986 as part of the Tax Reform Act in Reagan's second term, and when he decided that what he did in his first term hadn't worked out.
So that the companies would have to pay some however small amount of tax each year?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's nominally can be as much as 10% of their profits. Often it's less, though.
So it's now, what, some 15 years later?
Right.
And what is the Bush administration pushing? Not only repealing this, but giving the money back?
Right. The plan that the House passed and the president supported would repeal the minimum tax so that these companies could go back to not paying much of anything in taxes, and in addition, give them back all the minimum taxes they've paid for the last 15 years right away as a check from the Treasury. So it'd be a check, you know, how you got your $600 or $300 rebate last fall. Well, IBM would get a $1.4 billion check and so forth.
Is this what the corporations have been pushing for? I mean, did this go beyond even their wildest expectations?
Well, no, they've been pushing for something like this ever since the minimum tax was adopted. A lot of them were very happy to be avoiding all of their tax liabilities, and they'd like to go back to what they think are the good old days, and a lot of us think are the bad old days. And this is just, you know, the tip of the iceberg in the House bill, by the way. There's a whole bunch of other business tax breaks that over the first 3 years, the House bill was $212 billion in total, and three-quarters of that was for corporate tax breaks.
So tell us what happened last night.
Last night? You mean with the negotiations?
Yes.
Nobody's quite sure what's going on there. Both sides are trying to position themselves so they don't look too bad if this falls apart. The Democrats are continuing to insist that the bill be directed at stimulating consumer spending and as a added benefit, helping those who have been hurt by the recession and by the terrorist attacks. And the Republicans are insisting that it not be short-term, that it have long-term effects that will make our budget problems even worse and be directed at corporations. And they're not getting that close together yet, so we'll see what happens.
I'm looking at an AP report, and it says Senator John Breaux, the Democrat of Louisiana, said after a Tuesday night meeting between a group of centrist senators and Bush at the White House that the president's proposal could be a basis for a compromise that hopefully a significant number of Democrats could support with a significant number of Republicans. The revised White House proposal, which reflects many of the Democrats' priorities, scales back the president's proposed tax cuts, increases aid to the jobless, including assistance with health insurance, with popular business tax breaks included. It could cost $93 billion in 2002. Bush planned to put the package on the table today at a meeting with top four congressional leaders, including Daschle. Many Democrats continue to oppose accelerating the effective dates of income tax cuts passed earlier this year.
They really haven't changed it very much. It's window dressing mostly. They've got essential repeal of the minimum tax still in the bill. They've got these big increase in business write-offs over the next 3 years that will cost more than $100 billion just for that one item. They're still speeding up the rate cuts as the House bill did, so not a lot of movement on their part.
What is it that you see most egregious in this, what's called an economic stimulus package?
Well, I mean, the big picture, I think, is the most egregious in the sense that this isn't very stimulative. They spend a great deal of money, but all of it goes to corporations in the hope, they say, that companies will buy some more machinery. Well, our problem now is that companies have a lot of machinery they're not using because we have overcapacity. And the way you deal with that problem is to stimulate consumer demand. So just giving the money to the companies and hoping they might buy some machines they won't even plug in doesn't make very much economic sense. And then the second problem is, you know, everybody agreed after September 11th we needed to do something to help the people who were hurt by the recession and the attacks. And all of a sudden that seems to be out the window largely for the House Republicans and the president. They give lip service to it. They talk about it, but they don't really put any money behind it.
In what ways do you see a space for people to weigh in at this point?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that they are not trying to sell the Republicans or their stimulus package by what it really is. They keep trying to pretend it's something else because they know the public doesn't like the idea of turning this stimulus bill into another round of upper income and corporate tax cuts. So the one thing the public can do is keep reminding the politicians that they do know what's going on, and that will, I think, keep them in check.
Well, I want to thank you, Bob McIntyre, very much for being with us. What do you see as a timetable for the voting on this plan? The Republicans call it economic stimulus, group of public interest groups calling it Campaign Contributors War Profiteering Act of 2001.
If they don't get something done this week, it's going to be put off till next year, I think. And I don't know whether they will or not.
Bob McIntyre, Director of Citizens for Tax Justice, the website www.ctj.org. We're going to take an early break. When we come back, Manning Marable on war, globalization, and race. Stay with us. Star here on the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In the first criminal indictment related to the September 11th attacks, a federal grand jury charged a French Moroccan with multiple conspiracy counts. Zacharias Moussaoui is 33 years old, jailed August 17th on immigration charges in Minnesota, where he'd raised suspicions by seeking flight lessons. He'll be arraigned on January 2nd in Alexandria, Virginia, and faces trial in federal court, not before a military tribunal. If convicted, he could get the death penalty. A number of countries, particularly European Union countries, have said that they will not extradite suspects to the United States if they face military tribunals or the death penalty. Today, we're going to talk about the war abroad and the war at home by listening to a speech by Manning Marable, Director of African American Studies at Columbia University here in New York. Among his other books, How Capitalism Underdeveloped America, Problems in Race, Political Economy, and Society, he spoke at a conference on globalization and resistance at the City University of New York. This is Professor Manning Marable.
There are two great strategic tasks that are required for social justice movements, and especially for the left and activists of color today in the United States, especially in the wake of 9/11. The first is to make the political connections between class inequality, neoliberalism, and the accelerating racialization of U.S. society. That is, to make the connections between institutionalized racial oppression and how it manifests itself in things like mass incarceration, The dismantling of nearly all public institutions that low-income and working people depend upon, like schools and public health clinics, and the declining standard of living for most working families, regardless of their race or ethnicity. We need to ask hard questions like how does school privatization and the dismantling of public welfare and social assistance accelerate class inequality and racialization? The second task in the aftermath of 9/11 is for us to make, as progressives and as the left and as activists of color, to make a direct connection between globalization, racism, and war. The domestic response that we have now witnessed to the war against Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda has little to do with a struggle to combat terrorism or protect the American people than a pretext, a justification for the construction of what I believe to be a national security state, a structure of state power for neoliberalism, because neoliberalism is hostile to democracy. It needs a neo-authoritarian state structure in order to carry it out its domestic and global economic agenda. And so this afternoon, I'd like to focus on issues of class inequality. That is to say, an anti-globalization movement must speak a language of class. That is, class matters. It must not be reserved or reluctant to say that globalization is indeed imperialism. It must not be reluctant to use a Marxian political economic analysis to point to the increased racialization of U.S. society, the growth of the prison industrial complex, as processes that flow logically from a political economy in which 1% of a total U.S. of a total population in our country has a greater combined net wealth than 94% of the country. In other words, racialization and inequality flow out of who owns what within the society, and anti-globalization must speak that kind of language. Secondly, we need to talk in about the domestic political implications of 9/11. That we need an anti-globalization politics that does speak to this use of war as a pretext to the construction of a national security state. And finally, we need to have an anti-globalization politics that sees the importance of positioning ourselves politically from the vantage point of the third world, that of the underdeveloped South, rather than from the perspective of the first world, the U.S. and Western Europe. The anti-globalization mass movement must ground itself into the daily lives, that is, articulate the lived experiences of the 2 billion people on this planet who are hungry and malnourished, and the 3 billion people on this planet who are illiterate. It must not be a movement of privilege, but rather a movement that sees the world not from the top down, but from the bottom up. If we look inside of the United States and see what the implications are to globalization, we can observe that many of the most serious problems that we find within our cities today, the underfunded schools, deteriorating public transportation, the closed libraries, the public health clinics shut down, are all generated and driven by class inequality. During the last 2 decades, the real wages of most U.S. workers at the bottom 60% of the population stagnated or fell. Now, this is during a period of so-called massive economic boom, an unprecedented economic expansion in U.S. history. Most of the increase of the wealth in the last 20 years has gone to the wealthiest 1% of U.S. households. Wage inequality in the United States is today at an unprecedented level. Now, how does this get played out in cities or communities across the country? Well, here in New York City, During the 1990s, a period of economic expansion, low-wage workers' salaries actually fell nearly 10% in this city. The class inequality gap in New York City is widening. This is before the 2001 economic recession. According to the Fiscal Policy Institute in New York City, the average incomes of the richest 20% in 2000 were 20 times greater than the poorest 20% of families in the 1990s. In other words, millions of U.S. families earn more money than they did in 1990, but they cannot afford decent housing. 3 million households have critical housing needs. 76% spend more than one half of their incomes on housing. About 500,000 Americans live in homeless shelters or on the streets on any given night in the year 2001. Roughly 2 million people are homeless at some time every year during the late 90s and the early 21st century. Now that we have entered the worst recession since the 1974-75 recession, and millions of women and children of color and working poor people are becoming more vulnerable than ever before. When the 60-year-old federal safety net was destroyed and discarded, several million women and children saw their incomes in the late 90s plummet. In 1994, about three-fourths of those eligible for food stamps were receiving them. By the end of the decade, it fell to nearly 50%. About half of all families on temporary assistance for needy families periodically go without food. About 40% currently lack health coverage. This escalating inequality has had a direct impact upon the growing numbers of poor and racialized minorities in our prisons. We see the economic consequences of class inequality through racialization and mass incarceration. During the period from 1980 to 2000, the combined expenditures for state, federal, and local governments on police increased 400%. Corrections expenditures for building new prisons, upgrading existing facilities, hiring more guards, and related costs increased 1,000%. Now, the greatest victims of mass incarceration and racialization and class inequality are, of course, Latino and Black young people in this racialized U.S. society. In April 2000, utilizing national and state data compiled by the FBI, the Justice Department issued a comprehensive survey documenting these racial disparities in the dynamics of mass incarceration in the prison industrial complex. African Americans under the age of 18 comprise 15% of their national age group, yet they currently comprise 26% of those who are arrested. Now, after entering the criminal justice system, Black and white juveniles with the identical records are treated in fundamentally different ways. According to the study, among white youthful offenders, 66% are referred to juvenile courts, while only 31% of all African American youth are taken there. Blacks comprise 44% of those detained in juvenile jails, 46% of all those tried in adult criminal courts, and 58% of all juveniles who are warehoused in adult prisons. In practical terms, this means that African Americans who are arrested and charged for a crime, that they are more than 6 times more likely to be assigned to prison than white youthful offenders. For young people who have never been to prison before, African Americans are 9 times more likely than whites to be sentenced to juvenile prisons. And for youths charged with drug offenses, Black youths are 48 times more likely than white youths to be sentenced to juvenile prisons, 48 times. We take a look at Sing Sing Prison or any prison throughout this state, and what we see is 94% of all admissions in Sing Sing, and about 92% statewide, of all prisoners currently incarcerated in New York State prisons for drug offenses around the Rockefeller drug laws, nonviolent drug offenders, are Black and Latino, 94%. Today, there are over 2 million Americans incarcerated. And while the racialization aspect of this should be an issue we focus on in a globalization from below politics, it is imperative for us to see the class dynamic of this as well. About one-third of all prisoners were unemployed at the time of their arrests. Only 55% of all prisoners held full-time jobs in the year prior to their arrests. About 70% of all prisoners in state and federal penitentiaries earned less than $15,000 a year prior to their arrest. In other words, our prisons have become the chief means of warehousing the unemployed, racialized minorities, the unskilled, and the poor. A globalization from below must speak to mass incarceration, the prison industrial complex, and make the link between class inequality and racialization and privatization. There can be no privatization in a neoliberal, capitalist, private market-based economy without racialization. Racialization and privatization are part of the same dynamic. An anti-globalization movement must speak to the political economy of race and gender and class in an effective way. Second point. Now, several weeks ago in the New York Times, I'm going to run out of time if I don't wrap this up. All right, I'm going to skip the second section. I'm sorry, because I want to get to this third point about viewing. No, okay. Well, all right, then I'll go ahead. Okay. Several weeks ago in the New York Times, Clyde Haberman, right, wrote this piece that I want to talk a little bit about on this second point of the domestic implications of the politics post 9/11. Haberman writes, there is, quote, a connection between the emotional rubble of the World Trade Center nightmare and Amadou Diallo. You remember Amadou, the unarmed West African immigrant gunned down with 41 shots by the NYPD Street Crimes Unit. This is what Haberman wrote, quote, it is quite possible that America will have to decide, and fairly soon, how much license it wants to give law enforcement agencies to stop ordinary people at airports and border crossings, to question them at length about where they have been and where they're going and what they intend to do once they get where they're going. It would be probably no surprise if ethnic profiling enters the equation. Now, Haberman reluctantly acknowledged that Giuliani, quote, may be an authoritarian at heart. Maybe. But then he adds, quote, as a wounded New York mourns its unburied dead and turns to its mayor for solace. Public concerns about civil rights and civil liberties violations would necessarily recede. In other words, he implies that the rights of people like Amadou Diallo, he implies that the rights of racialized minorities and people from low-income and unemployed neighborhoods, the rights of those people of color in this city are somehow secondary or tertiary to the personal safety of the white upper middle class. Now, as the national media has picked up the drumbeat on the war on terrorism, we've seen the implications of a politics of globalization and neoliberalism here at home, the rise of neo-authoritarianism. New York State legislature, in the span of a week, created a new crime, quote unquote, terrorism, with a maximum penalty of life imprisonment. Anyone convicted of giving more than $1,000 to any organization defined by state authorities as terrorist will face up to 15 years in state prison. Now, when you think for a minute that it was not too many years ago that the African National Congress was a terrorist organization, and when you think only for a few seconds that the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, is still defined as a terrorist organization, the danger of suppressing any activities by U.S. citizens that support third world liberation movements now has become all too clear and all too real. We will soon see, if we haven't already, dissident profiling, the proliferation of electronic surveillance, roving wiretapping, harassment at the workplace, the infiltration and disruption of anti-war groups, the stigmatization of any critics of U.S. Militarism as disloyal and subversive. What the anti-globalization movement in this country needs to say, and say loudly, is you cannot preserve democracy by restricting and eliminating democratic rights. To publicly oppose the government's policies, which one knows to be morally bankrupt and politically ridiculous, is expressing the strongest belief and faith in the principles of democracy. And that's what we should be saying. We must clearly explain to the American people that missile strikes and indiscriminate carpet bombings we are unleashing against peasants in Afghanistan will not make us safer. The policies of the Bush regime actually put our lives in greater danger because the use of government-sponsored terror will not halt brutal retaliations by the terrorists. The national security state apparatus that we are busily constructing today is designed primarily to suppress domestic dissent. Third point. The bombing campaign against the people of Afghanistan, I believe, in history will be described by the phrase, the U.S. against the third world. The United States government cannot engage in effective multilateral actions against international terrorism because its own behavior illustrates its complete contempt for international cooperation. The United States owed $582 million in back dues to the United Nations and only paid up when, after 9/11 attacks jeopardized its own national security. Republican conservatives demand that the United States should be exempt from the jurisdiction of an international criminal court. For the 2001 World Conference Against Racism, the U.S. government authorized an allocation of a paltry $250,000 versus $12 million it gave to the Beijing Conference for Women in 1995. Now, the U.S. media and opinion makers have repeatedly gone out of their way to twist the facts on these issues. For three decades, the U.S. refused to ratify the 1965 U.N. Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racism and xenophobia. Is it any wonder that much of the third world questions U.S. motives? The carpet bombing of the Taliban seems to the third world to have a lot less to do with the suppression of terrorism and a lot more to do with securing future petroleum product rights inside of Central Asia. Exxon Mobil, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler, they are bigger combined in terms of their combined wealth than the gross domestic products of 182 countries. In fact, of the world's largest 100 economies, 49 are countries and 51 are corporations. How do we see the events from the third world perspective? There's a direct linkage between the events of September the 11th and the politics that occurred in Durban at the World Conference Against Racism. The U.S. government in Durban opposed the definition of slavery as a crime against humanity. It refused to acknowledge the historical and contemporary effects of colonialism, racial segregation, and apartheid on the underdevelopment and oppression of the non-European world. It polemically manipulated charges of anti-Semitism to evade and avoid discussions concerning the rights of Palestinian people to self-determination. The world's subaltern masses represented at Durban sought to advance a new global dialogue about the political economy of race globally, and the United States insulted the entire global community. Should we be surprised, therefore, that Palestinian children celebrate in the streets of their occupied territories when they see televised images of our largest buildings being destroyed? Should we be shocked that hundreds of protest marches in opposition to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan are being held throughout the world? The vast majority of dark humankind is saying to the U.S. that racism, war, and militarism are not the solution to the world's major problems. Transnational corporate capitalism and repressive neoliberal policies of structural adjustment represent a dead end for the developing world. We can only end the threat of terrorism by addressing constructively the routine violence of poverty, the routine violence of hunger, the routine violence of class exploitation, characterizing the daily existence of billions of people on the planet Earth. Racism is, after all, in the final analysis, only another form of violence. To stop the violence of terror and war, we must also stop the violence of racism and class inequality. To struggle for peace, to find new paths toward reconciliation, both domestically and globally, is the only way to safeguard our cities, the United States, our country, and ourselves from the violence of terror and the dangers of war. Because without the fight for justice, and without justice, there will never be, and can never be, any peace. Thank you.
Professor Manning Marable, Director of African American Studies at Columbia University in New York. Among his other books, How Capitalism Underdeveloped America, Problems in Race, Political Economy, and Society. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll hear from a man who worked in a factory that made American flags in Miami, run by Goodwill Industries. He was fired after saying publicly he opposed the bombing of Afghanistan. Stay with us.
Our precious right to not be shown. The gory deeds we do.
Peter Quick, Counting on the Flag, a song for the patriotic, a listener who sent in his music. And you can let us know about yours as well. You can send us email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The flag, what does it stand for? Well, yesterday on the program, we heard the story of Katie Sierra, a 15-year-old high school student from Charleston, West Virginia, suspended for wearing a T-shirt to school on which she'd written, "When I saw the dead and dying Afghani children on TV, I felt a newly recovered sense of national security. God bless America." School board members even accused Katie of treason for her anti-war views, and she is now suspended from school. She's suing the school, and she's homeschooling. Well, the assault on free speech extends from the workplace, from school to the workplace. In Miami, Florida, recently, a man who worked in a factory that made American flags was fired for stating publicly he opposed the bombing of Afghanistan. He joins us now in our Firehouse studio in New York. His name is Michael Attali. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you. Good morning.
So tell us your story.
Well, I was a candidate for mayor, as you stated, in Miami. The elections held about 1 month ago. I was the Socialist Workers Party candidate, and in my campaign, I was speaking out on a number of issues, speaking against the bombing and the troops being sent to Afghanistan. I believe the U.S. government is taking advantage of the events at the World Trade Center to expand its military and economic domination of the region. I was speaking in defense of unions, ability of workers to organize on the job, in defense of the Cuban Revolution. And I appeared in a candidate's debate on October 18th, which was televised, which opened up the subsequent events in which I was fired from my job. I appeared on the TV explaining my point of view on these issues. The next 2 days, for the first time ever, supervisors started coming up to me on the job, asking me, what are your views? What party are you with? Questions like this. I don't like talking to my supervisors about politics, so I just said, you know, it's hard to work and talk at the same time. So then they asked if I'd like to go out to lunch with them, and I said, no, thank you, I have other things to do. 2 days after that, I started work as usual at 7 in the morning at Goodwill. Goodwill is about 500 people workforce making military uniforms, flags, etc. I start at 7 o'clock in the morning as usual at my machine. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon, about 1/2 hour before quitting time, the top supervisor says you're needed in personnel. So I go to personnel, and waiting for me there is the head of security. And he has a piece of paper in front of him with some handwritten lines on it. He seems to be using that as his text. And he says in these words, I've been assigned to tell you that because of your views of the U.S. government, which are contrary to those of this agency, referring to Goodwill as a nonprofit agency, because of your views of the U.S. government, which are contrary to those of this agency, you are a disruptive force and cannot work here anymore. Take your things and go. I asked him if I could have a copy of what he read from. He said no. I asked if I could have his business card. He said no. You have to go. He walked me out where there's a security guard waiting at my car to make sure I left the area. I believe this is a serious attack on all workers' rights to be able to speak out on issues from unions to war policies without fear of losing their job, without fear of harassment on the job. And so I've helped initiate a committee to defend free speech and the Bill of Rights in Miami, with committees being formed in other cities around the country. I'm on a national tour right now, speaking out against these attacks on myself and other issues like the one that you mentioned just a moment ago, the high school student who was kicked out of school for expressing her opposition to the war. This is a serious attack on people to be able to speak out, and especially workers on the job, where there is another worker in Miami who was recently fired, Muhammad Rahat. He's a 22-year-old lab tech at the University of Miami, supposedly an institution of higher learning and intellectual debate. He was a lab tech on September 11th, happened to be his birthday. And he said a sarcastic remark along the lines of, this is hell of a birthday present from Osama bin Laden. And then in a private conversation, he said to a coworker, while he didn't like at all what happened at the World Trade Center, it didn't surprise him considering U.S. policy in the Middle East. A third person overheard him say this to someone else, reported to the supervisor, who then suspended Mr. Rahat and a few days later fired him. This made the front page of the Miami Herald. The administration was asked about this. The president of University of Miami is Donna Shalala of Clinton administration fame. She has not commented on this, but a university spokesperson, when told that Mr. Rahat had an excellent work record, said his work record is immaterial. We fired him for what he said. What's important about these firings is that they're blatant political firings. Usually when an employer wants to get rid of someone they don't like, they say that you have a bad work record or poor attendance or some other excuse. In this case, he said straight up, I'm firing you for your political views. He said this to the Miami Herald. He said this to television news. He said that, to quote him, We cannot have anyone who is attempting to subvert the United States of America in this plant. His political beliefs are those of a communist who would like to destroy private ownership of American enterprises and install a communist regime in the United States. No other excuse. And recently I've actually won a victory along these lines in which the state of Florida has ruled as well that I was fired for my political views. I filed for unemployment when I was fired 6 weeks ago, stating that the reason for my discharge was being fired for political views. They asked the company for its response to my accusation. The company did not respond. And on Monday, I received a check for $781 for 6 weeks at $158 a week, roughly, unemployment benefits. And they also sent a determination, their findings. And it says Mr. Talley was discharged for his political views. No evidence of misconduct on the job was indicated. Therefore, I receive the benefits.
Now, in reading the Miami Herald pieces on your firing, the president of Goodwill, the factory in Miami, very much stood up for the CEO, whatever the guy who heads the company, you being fired for your political beliefs. He had carefully researched it legally, he said.
He stated to the Miami Herald that he had talked to his attorneys, and you can tell from, if you know this guy, you can tell he doesn't like the fact that his attorneys told him that he could not fire someone for race, religion, or national origin, but he could fire someone for his political views. And he said after talking to his attorneys, he decided he would fire me for my political views. But there's an extra danger in that, because implied there is he cannot fire you because you're black, but he can fire you if you advocate black rights. He can't fire you for being a woman, but he can fire you for advocating women's rights. He can't fire you for being an immigrant, but he can fire you for advocating bilingual education. So I think it very much gets to the heart of the first, if you don't have the First Amendment, a right to speak and advocate your ideas, then all of the other rights on the job can soon go out the window, whether it's the fight against discrimination on the job in all forms.
The ACLU, though, Michael Attali, said that they would not represent you in your case, what you called a free speech case.
That's true. After I held a press conference at the factory and the media asked the ACLU of Miami their opinion on this, they said they would not. They make a distinction that a private employer, they say, if it's not union, and this place was not union, and if you're not in a what's called a protected category, such as race, religion, national origin, then a private employer can fire you for any reason or no reason at all. I disagree with that. Maybe 90% of the population works in private employers and without a union, unfortunately. I don't believe that the First Amendment goes out the window once you walk into that factory or office or other workplace. And in fact, while the ACLU has not changed its legal position on this, the executive director of the Florida ACLU, Howard Simon, spoke at a program in Miami just this past Saturday, a panel of speakers in which I participated, stating that the firing of Mohammed Rahat are serious attacks on democratic rights, come in the context of the military tribunals and other attacks from the Bush administration, and these attacks need to be spoken out against.
Can you talk about the press conference that you held outside of the factory and what happened to the workers inside when you did?
Yes. I knew as soon as they fired me, I was going to fight this firing. And several days later, I held a press conference outside the plant. Most people get out at 4:30. And so I scheduled the press conference for 4 p.m., hoping to be able to talk to coworkers, get them information about why they fired me. So the company found out about this because the media asked them what their response was to my charges of a political firing. So at 2:30 in the afternoon, I found this out from friends who work in the plant. At 2:30 in the afternoon, they went around to everybody and told them, Mike is going to be outside with the media having a press conference. At 3:00, I want everybody in the factory to leave. We're closing the plant an hour and a half early because we don't want you staying around, talking to Mike, talking to the media, finding out what's happening. And in fact, don't clock out at 3:00, but write down on your time card 4:30 so you'll get a full day's pay. the media, and this I had this on tape, actually, the media that covered my press conference went to the security guard at the plant at 3 o'clock. They happened to get there early or a little bit after 3 and said, you know, the plant has been closed down. What's going on? They wouldn't comment. So they asked, can we go in and talk to the administration? They said, no, we're not allowing the media in here at all. No one can talk to you. You'll have to come back another time. I talked to a coworker about this, why she thought why they closed it early. And she said, this was very good, very deep what she said. She said they closed the plant early because they didn't want the media talking to us, the workers in the factory, because then the conditions in the plant might get publicity, might get out. That Goodwill Industries, which presents itself as a benefactor and aid to the disabled, pays people, the vast majority of people make less than $14,000 a year, receive no medical benefits. And many people are paid less than the minimum wage because there are exceptions to the minimum wage laws that they're allowed to pay disabled people less than minimum wage. So they pay people by the piece, and they pay, including disabled workers, piece rate. And so I have coworkers who have one good arm and are working putting two pieces of material together, and they take home, we get paid every 2 weeks. And it's not uncommon for disabled workers to get a two-week paycheck, 80 hours, of $75, $100, $125. They don't want these facts getting out.
And these are people who are making the American flag?
Including people who make, I'm sure it includes people making the American flag, yes.
And you were stitching Navy wear?
I was working on the pieces of the front of Navy jackets.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Michael Attali, who worked at a Goodwill factory in Miami, fired explicitly for expressing his point of view against the war in Afghanistan. He was running for Miami mayor on the Socialist Workers Party ticket. What did the other candidates say about you?
Well, two other candidates, there were 10 candidates in all in the race, two other candidates signed statements opposing the firing. That was very good. Jose Garcia Pedrosa and Danny Couch each spoke against the firing. But one, the libertarian candidate, Mr. Atunes, he said that he didn't give an opinion about what he thought about the firing, but he thought it was an employer's right to fire someone for any reason, and he didn't think that employers should be prevented from firing someone for race, religion, or national origin either. It's up to the employer to have free choice in this matter. But he also said that he didn't think the employer was so much concerned with my opinion on Afghanistan, but the fact that I support a $10 an hour minimum wage, that would be a direct cut in his profits. And this candidate, totally serious without joking, said, and that scares me too, because he's a businessman. He doesn't want to have to pay people higher wages.
Michael Attali, if people want to get in touch with you, where can they call or go on the web?
The local number in the New York area is 718-434-4776. And the Committee to Defend Free Speech and the Bill of Rights is having a meeting on Thursday, December 20th at 6 p.m. It's going to be held at the Union Hall for the Communication Workers of America, Local 1180. That's at 6 Harrison Street, the third floor. And that's 6 Harrison Street, which is between Hudson and Leonard Streets.
And that's in Manhattan. And we'll put it on our website at democracynow.org. I want to thank you very much for being with it. That does it for the program. Sorry, we are out of time. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner, Suganya Mahendra, and Matthew Power. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Al Maitland at the helm at WBIX. You can reach us at mail@democracynow.org. Special thanks to Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuna. We're also broadcasting on public access cable stations and on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Let the joyous news be spread. Let the joyous news be spread. The wicked old witch at last is dead.